Just before the break, Frank, you mentioned that it might still be around in Ethiopia, or at least a copy or one of the Ark of the Covenants, if there's more than one, and we'll follow that up in a minute. That would indicate to me that just because you have the Ark of the Covenant doesn't necessarily make you powerful.
Again, it depends on how it's used or misused, or maybe they don't know how to use it. The power that's involved is of all kinds. You can become militarily powerful, economically, or spiritually powerful. And who's to say that the people in Ethiopia today don't have a very rich spiritual life?
Right. We don't know, and we can't judge that. I'm following into the definition of power is military might or strong. And actually, as you mentioned, power may actually be something totally different. Real power may be a spiritual or a religious thing.
Absolutely, and don't forget that the Ark of the Covenant was never made to be a military device. It was not made to engender great economic prosperity, except in the sense that it made civilization possible in an area that was otherwise pretty much uninhabitable because of
it. Yeah, so you're saying it was put here in certain regions of the earth to make civilization prosper. In other words, it was not much different than if it's probably a bad analogy, but taking the dam system of REA and creating electrical energy and making possible to have lights, electricity, and everything in Appalachia.
Well, the appropriate analogy, and it serves, I think, to explain exactly what this object was. When Egyptian civilization began, the Nile Valley was very tempting because it's agriculturally one of the richest places on earth. You just throw any kind of a seed in the alluvial soil and you're guaranteed it's going to grow. You've got two growing seasons. Unfortunately, the river itself is in fact a fault zone. It was created by earthquake activity. There was more earthquake activity there than has been there recently, but it certainly is still seismically unstable. So if you're going to establish a civilization there, you've got to do something to ameliorate those worst effects of seismicity. And I think that's exactly what the Great Pyramid and its other pyramids did. It's interesting, if you look at a topographical map of the Nile Valley, you can see that these ancient pyramids are all on either side, right up and down, like a zipper, on either side of the Nile River. And that was because what they were used to stabilize, used to damp down, as it were.
In other words, basically the pyramids, and we've done many shows about this, it appears that it probably was some sort of, for lack of a better term, planetary engineering. Yeah. In other words, it had something to do with the climate and changing things and the geological area itself. I mean, we're not really completely sure what all it was for.
Well, I feel very confident I know what it was for.
Oh, really?
Yes, I do. I think that the Great Pyramid served only one chief purpose, and that was just to damp down earthquake activity. I think that earthquakes still took place while this device was working, but they were of minor tremors compared to the major quakes that they could have caused. So I think that the Great Pyramid was made for only one thing, and I think the proof of that, I can prove that for our listeners pretty easily without going into all the book. If you take an illustration of the cross-section of the Great Pyramid, you can go to any library and find an illustration of that. It shows the configuration of the king's chamber, the queen's chamber, the corridors, and so the gallery, and so on. You look at that cross-section, and then you go to an encyclopedia, or you go to a work on electronic devices, and you look up a transducer. Look at the cross-section of a transducer. It's right on. You can have a template of the cross-section of a transducer and the cross-section of the Great Pyramid. Well, I visited the Great Pyramid several times, and I can tell you for a fact that there's no way that you could have a funeral in there, you could get a sarcophagus inside, there's no decoration whatsoever inside the Great Pyramid, never was, there's no accommodation for statues or anything of that kind. The Great Pyramid is the most un-Egyptian of all of the structures throughout Egypt, because the Egyptians loved to cover everything with hieroglyphs and everything was ceremonial. There is nothing at all ceremonial about inside the Great Pyramid. Also, if you could take the inside the Great Pyramid and fill it with people, I don't think you can get 200 people in there.
Oh, really?
Oh, stretching 200 people. There's not enough room because the corridors are very narrow. The largest chamber itself is only 18 by 18 by 18 feet, which is a cube. And that's an interesting thing about that. People say, "How? What is the relationship?" But you're talking about the Ark of the Covenant the Hebrews had and the Stone of Destiny that the Egyptians had. Well, let me tell you this, that the inside of the king's, so-called king's chamber in the Great Pyramid at 18 feet is exactly the dimensions of the Holy of Holies that King Solomon established in the temple that he set up for the Ark of the Covenant. But more significant than that, and this fits in remarkably well, the dimensions for the Ark of the Covenant are spelled out exactly, precisely, in royal cubits in Exodus in the Old Testament. It's roughly about 2 feet wide, 2 feet high, and about 3 feet long. And these dimensions fit perfectly with inside the so-called sarcophagus that is inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. There was an experiment done in 1950, and there's been several experiments, same type, reproduced. And in 1950, an exact reproduction of the Ark of the Covenant, minus its gold covering, made out of wood, this replica was made and brought into the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, and it fit like a glove inside the sarcophagus of the King's Chamber. So I think that the chances of these dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant itself fitting so perfectly inside the sarcophagus and the exact same dimensions of Solomon's Temple and the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid indicate that this object was in fact removed and reproduced from ancient Egypt into ancient Israel.
Yeah, it circumstantially, it defies logic if it's not true.
No, it would just be an incredible.
Yeah.
But I think that the Great Pyramid was made as a geotransducer. In other words, its job only was to very mundane purposes, but it's still a wonderful device that we should have today. We can make today, I think, is to damp down the worst effects of earthquake.
Well, I wonder why in Western civilization we haven't tried that.
Well, it's been right in front of us all this time. I'm not the first one to have discovered this. Well, I did discover it on my own, and I felt very proud and happy about it, and then my ego was shattered when I found out about a wonderful book called The Giza Power Plant by Christopher Dunn, who in fact is an engineer out of Illinois, Danville, Illinois, and he has shown, I think, extremely convincingly that the Great Pyramid was a machine, a solid-state device, and its most important component was this crystal, this about a two-foot-long crystal that later became the Ark of the Covenant.
Is your feeling that the crystal is from this earth, naturally, or do you know?
Well, I believe that the crystal is definitely made on Earth. I think it is a device that we know today as an electronic quartz crystal.
Okay.
And electronic quartz crystals today are...
And we have quartz everywhere.
Right, quartz is everywhere. But the difference between electronic quartz crystal and other types of crystal, electronic quartz crystals are used in electrical industry today, is that all of the rutilations have been straightened out. What I mean by that is that every crystal has lines in them, or striations. They grow naturally, and they go in different directions. And the straighter that those rutilations happen to be, the clearer the crystal is. And there is a process of straightening out these lines today in a quartz crystal, and it makes it very, very clear. The reason why they do that is because the straighter the lines are in there, the more effective this electronic crystal will be. And I believe that that's what the ancients did. I think they made an electronic quartz crystal, or they found a crystal that was very, very clear, in which all of the rutilations were very straight, and therefore it became electronically very potent. I don't believe it was made by a civilization outside the Earth. I think it was made by our ancestors. Exactly who made it, I don't know, because the Egyptians inherited this crystal.
That's what I was getting at.
I feel far more confident on where the Ark is today, or this crystal, than where it came from. Because the Egyptian story, and here we're going back to the very beginnings of history, the Egyptians said that the stone was brought by a man by the name of Thaut, T-H-A-U-T, and that he lived with his fellow immortals and mortals on an island out in the ocean, and that one day this island began to sink under the iniquity of its people. And so Fount, this is the Egyptian story now, I'm not making this up.
Sure, I understand.
Fount brought something called the Emerald Tablet, and that this Emerald Tablet had written on it all of the wisdom of this former civilization that was sinking into the sea. And it's referred to as an emerald, not that it was actually an emerald. The word emerald was used in a poetic sense to describe it as being a stone of great value, great preciousness. And he brought this Emerald Tablet to the Nile Valley, and because of the wisdom and the power of this stone, he allowed civilization to flourish, to begin again in the Nile Valley. And then he took the stone and enshrined it inside the Great Pyramid, where its name was changed and became the Phoenix Stone. In other words, a stone that arose out of the fire. It's also known as the Fire Stone and the Stone of Destiny. And during a period of tremendous upheaval in Egypt, when Egypt was invaded by its enemies, and that part of Egypt was occupied by its enemies, that's when the stone was taken out of the Great Pyramid and eventually wound up in the hands of the Hebrews, who used it in the gold box, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the things that we talk about here, and it's prevalent throughout history, especially in biblical history, but in prehistoric or ancient times, really better, I guess a better term, is the element of gold. Gold always seems to be very important to all of this.
Yes, it is.
And I know I have a good friend, Jim Mars, who believes that the gold is, the important part about gold is probably not the monetary value or even the industrial value, but it has some sort of secret to life itself. And when you melt it down, there's a powder residue left or whatever. In other words, what we're getting at here with my statement is gold seems to be very important in all of these civilizations.
Yes, it is. I know Mars has done some really fascinating work in that direction. He's way ahead of me there. I really don't feel like.
Yeah, I'm not even trying to get you to endorse it or not, but I mean, but I think, you know, it's so far out, but at the same time, it there may be something there, because it does seem to be an underlying element of all these invasions, all these military actions, all these people wanting power.
Well, the only thing I can say, I can address myself to that, is that the gold, as far as I knew, was used as gold leaf on the Ark of the Covenant itself, and that it was used for strictly industrial purposes. It was used as a conductor.
Yes.
The same thing, interestingly enough, is the same stone, or the same type of stone, when it appears in other parts of the world. For example, it even appears in Peru. And when it goes to Peru, it goes to a place called Cusco, or the navel of the world, and there it's enshrined in the Coricanca. And the Coricanca is known as the enclosure of gold. It's the same thing. And you see these other traditions in the Pacific and in North Africa and Europe, where the stone finds itself many times in a golden enclosure, and that's because of its the power of gold as a conductor.
Yeah, we want to get back. We're going to take a break again, and when we get back, Frank, I want to pick this back up. We left the Ark of the Covenant here with four people, and the rest of the people were burned at the stake in France. I want to know what happened to it. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippen.
Major sighting here
on the 13th of March. Weird happenings in the skies over Phoenix recently, and no one seems to be able to explain what it was.
And now,
suddenly, six amber orbs in a row, totally equidistant from each other, massive span across, pop up.
People say they saw a strange bright light seen over the skies of Arizona. It gets a lot of people wondering.
There are another 10,000 Arizonans who saw the same thing.
Eyewitnesses who saw it say it's like nothing they've ever seen before.
Last night, shortly after 8 p.m., hundreds, maybe thousands of Arizonans reported seeing a triangular-shaped object with three to
thousands of people saw more than stars in the night sky.
The mystery remains unsolved and controversial.
There was nothing new.
Award-winning documentary by Dr. Lynn Kutaw, The Phoenix Lights, is now available from shockjerrypippen.com.
Order now. Supplies limited.
Frank, you're saying maybe there is more than one Ark of the Covenant all through history, or is this... I'm a little confused. Is there only one, or... You've alluded several times that there's several, they end up at different places, like one in Ethiopia, we mentioned, also in Japan. Is this the same Ark, or the same product, or how do you put this in perspective?
The Ark of the Covenant we're talking about is the one that's the Ark of the Covenant.
Okay.
It's in the Old Testament. However, there are so many traditions and different parts of the world that it's impossible that it is the same stone going over and over again. There's a very close, almost an exact same thing that's found in Tibet. It's known as the Chintamani stone. And the Chintamani stone is obviously not the one that is, we're talking about.
So in other words, different civilizations somehow came upon the same type of solid state machine.
I believe that there was a single place where this technology arose very high, that there was a prehistoric civilization that is unacknowledged by mainstream science, and that this civilization achieved was a very old civilization. Actually, there were two that I can identify in the book. I think there were two very old, long-lived civilizations, and during the course of the history of these civilizations, they were able to achieve things which today seem to us miraculous and unacceptable to conventional archaeologists. That these civilizations were run by people who were great observers of nature. One thing I've learned is that people in the ancient world and people today were no different than each other. Just because we have refrigerators and atomic bombs doesn't make us totally different than the people that came before us. That there were great and evil men in the past, just as there are great and evil men today. And that the people who lived in this prehistoric civilization were, as I said, great observers of the laws of nature, and they applied natural phenomena to their own society. And part of the observations that they made over many generations was the relationship between quartz crystal and earth energies. There's a phenomenon known as the Andes glow. The Andes glow has been photographed where the tops of mountains, especially in the Andes, but not only there, begin to glow sometimes with their own light. It's a blue light. And for many years it was considered just to be a legendary phenomenon until it was photographed really only about 16 years ago, first in Japan. Now it's been studied and applied specifically to Peru. And what happens is that if a mountain has large quantities of granitic quartz, and this mountain also happens to sit on top of a seismically active area, the same phenomenon takes place that I mentioned with the Ark of the Covenant. You have a piezoelectric effect in which the earth literally squeezes the quartz crystal. And when that happens, it produces an electrical discharge. And I think that people in the ancient world watched this phenomenon. They lived in some mountainous region where they saw this phenomenon taking place. They eventually put two and two together, and they realized that there was a relationship. I give you a very specific example. That's just kind of a supposition. I give you a very specific example. And that is the Indians of the American Southwest, America, in our own country. They have a very sacred place called Pinnacles National Monument in Southern California. And the shamans, the Indian shamans, and these are Indians that come from all over the American Southwest, they go to this place. It's one of the most sacred places that they know is Pinnacles. It's open to the public today, but long before it was their sacred place. And they go up on top of this, it's not a mountain, it's a kind of a sandstone formation. They look like great pillars or columns pointed at the top. And the shamans go on the top of these pinnacles, and they undergo tremendous spiritual transformations. They go through epiphanies, and they come down having seen God and so on. Great visions. Well, what's interesting about Pinnacles National Monument is that it is extremely, extraordinarily rich in quartz crystal, and that it sits right in the San Andreas Fault. The Andes glow, this blue discharge, has actually been photographed at Pinnacles National Monument, too. So here they're sitting in the midst of this negative ion fountain that's being discharged out of Pinnacles National Monument. I think that here we're dealing with Native Americans who sort of parallel what people in the ancient world.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and it seems to me like sitting in the middle of the San Andreas Fault, maybe it was put there to calm things down.
Well, the Pinnacles National Monument is not a man-made formation.
Yeah, I understand that. But
beyond just calming things down is that the person who is subjected to those negative ions is just going to have their consciousness blown wide open.
Yeah, and we talked about that earlier in the show. Whether
I think that's what people in the ancient world did, is that they understood this relationship, they engineered this stone and then made several stones, and then when their civilization perished, their movers and shakers went to other parts of the world and applied this stone to as the foundation.
Now, let's get back. You're a journalist, and you focused on the stone, I guess, a lot. The one
mostly on the present ark, right?
Right. What happened to it? And when they sneaked it away from
Mount Segur.
Yes.
Well, the story, as I said, diverges in many different directions. My own personal choice, although I'm quite willing to be proven wrong on this, is I think that what these four men did is that they did go very far with the Ark. The Pyrenees Mountains are honeycombed with literally tens of thousands of caves. Not all of them have been discovered so far. And I think what these four men did, rather than risk carrying it very far,
is probably hid it someplace.
I think they hid it there, but I think they hid it in a very specific place. I think they hid it in a cave that is walking distance, strangely enough, to a very powerful sacred site today. You can walk from Mount Segur to a place known as Lourdes. And Lourdes has become a mecca for sufferers from around the world, regardless of whether they're Christian or not, or Catholic or not. The number of physical healings reported there far outstrips any other place on earth. And I conclude that it makes the most sense that the Ark of the Covenant has found its proper original place in a mountain that is subjected to periodic seismicity, and that when that happens, the Ark is activated and irradiates its healing for people that are in the Lourdes area. The cave that the four Cathars took it to has got to be in very close proximity to that healing center.
Has anybody been over there looking for it?
You bet there have been.
But nobody's found it.
Oh, perhaps. Yeah.
Oh, ha ha! You think somebody may have it?
Yes, there was a man by the name of Otto Rahn, R-A-H-N. He was one of the greatest Grail scholars of all time. He was obsessed with the story of the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, this is, again, I'm cutting to a lot of chases here, but I think it seems very clear to me that when the Ark was transported from the Holy Land, from Jerusalem into Europe, they could no longer refer to it as the Ark of the Covenant because of its enemies, the popes and so on. So I believe that they put it within they renamed it within the context of a European tradition, and they called it the Holy Grail. I believe that the Ark of the Covenant and the mm-hmm. Holy Grail are one and the same object. So Otto Rahn was so obsessed with the Holy Grail, he became the leading scholar. His book, as a matter of fact, has just been reproduced again. He wrote a book in 1930 about it, and has just been reproduced, called Crusade Against the Grail. He mounted an expedition in the mid-1930s with the help of the German government, and he did find a large and very beautiful crystal in the Pyrenees Mountains. Now, whether this is the actual Ark, he did not find the Ark of the Covenant. He didn't find the gold box, but he did find a magnificent, beautiful crystal that was on top of a food altar.
This is why you alluded earlier in the conversation that maybe the Nazis had something to do with it.
Well, they certainly are involved. involved in this quest, or at least this man is. And Otto Rahn found a crystal. There's no doubt about it. It was 2 feet long, interestingly enough, the same basic dimensions. Very clear, very outstanding, beautiful crystal. And he and his confederates smuggled it back into Germany and put it into a Westphalian castle known as Wellwellsburg. And Wellwellsburg was administered by the SS under Heinrich Himmler, and it had its own, the stone, which was known as the Wellwellsburg stone, had its own room enshrined in this castle. I believe that he had one of these crystals. I don't think he had the Ark of the Covenant, but I think he had one of these crystals. The story, the silly movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is kind of a comic book, is very loosely based on Otto Rahn's experience, where they have people chasing around the world. So that, it's not right, but it's very loosely based on this. It's a fact that Otto Rahn existed and did, in fact, find this stone. The stone was enshrined in the castle, was seen by, well, select people, as it were. And at the end of World War II, as the Americans were within marching distance of Wellwellsburg in late March 1945, Heinrich Himmler ordered the Wellwellsburg stone removed and the castle demolished. We have all of the orders, all the papers for that. We know exactly who was involved, the names of the officers and everything, exactly when this came down. The Wellwellsburg stone, the castle itself, was utterly demolished except for its north tower. Interestingly enough, that's where the stone had been kept. And the stone itself was hidden in a Bavarian glacier. We don't know where that is, though, and it's still there in the glacier somewhere in Bavaria. But that stone, the Wellwellsburg stone, was just one of these stones that was part of this story, and that I believe that the original Ark of the Covenant in its gold box sits today inside a cave in the Pyrenees Mountains in the close vicinity of Lourdes.
We urge people to pick up the book. We have a link that they can order it from our website here and go find out a little bit more of information about what you're talking about. It's been an incredible hour. I have a couple of minutes left. I would assume that something that's taken you this long to do, and looking back over history of other people who have studied this and investigated it, it becomes an all-consuming thing. I mean, just this hour, you've had me hanging on my chair, What's next with you, Frank?
Well, you're right. It has been an obsession for the last 26 years. When I first started to get a clue on this thing, I began traveling around the world, and all my energies were devoted to find. We've just barely scratched the surface on this whole story.
Yeah, I understand that.
But as it is of now,
and we urge people to read the book.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I certainly appreciate it. Deeply appreciate it. There's been a kind of a closure with the book, though. I put it all together. I've said everything I could possibly say about it, and I feel very good about it. I feel very physically connected with this object. I think anybody that does really dwell on it or have a kind of meditation on it, you establish a kind of connection. It's a living thing, and I feel very much a part of it, but I don't feel distressed.
That's what I was getting.
No, I don't at all. I feel really great that
the unanswered question, I guess, is how did civilization, mankind, know about it in the first place, and where it came from? And I guess those answers really kind of left up to the individual.
Well, I provide some clues early on. Mm-hmm. I didn't have time to get into.
Yeah, right. I understand.
But I try to make it as clear as I possibly can for average readers like myself.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, and you've asked some really insightful questions. I really enjoyed this interview, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
I do, too.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.